Log Talk Radio.
Today we're talking about the real Underwood plan. When you plan with miles of cars, President Frank Underwood, the main character, came out with a stunning plan to put America back to where it's called America Works. In this plan, he has said that he would cut major entitlement programs in half to be able to pay for that program. We all have been sitting back wondering, is this possible in America? Today on this show, we have a couple of guests. One, John Jackson, an Atlanta resident, an economic expert who works in the banking industry, who will be talking about this from an economic perspective. And also, we have Christopher Sloan, West Georgia's finest political analyst and former chairman of the Troop County Democratic Party. We also have another guest, hopefully, will be calling in the next couple of minutes. And Mr. Jackson, I understand that you're on your way to Selma, Alabama. Can you kind of give us a feeling of what it feels like to be going down and taking part in this great event?
I am absolutely honored and blessed to be riding to Selma, Alabama. I've got a fine group of people with me, the lovely State Representative Darshan Kendrick. I've got my own rep, State Representative Tyrone Brooks, who is a civil rights legend, and I've got one of the best young political operatives in the game, DeAndre Eberhardt. I probably messed up his last name, but he will forgive me. But I got chills going down my spine, you know, and I really look forward to being present on this historical day.
Well, yeah, I wish I could be down there with you guys. It's hard for everybody to be in one spot at the same time. But I'm proud that we have such fine individuals in the car with you going down, being able to take place. Hold on, we got Kimberly Carter has come in. Miss Carter, how are you doing?
Oh, good afternoon, Scout Smith. Thank you for this opportunity. My apologies for my tardiness, but really glad to participate in this call today.
Well, you was in Selma yesterday, and Mr. Jackson, who's on his way down to Selma right now, just gave us his feelings on how he feels about being prepared to go take place. Since you were there yesterday, can you kind of give us a feeling of what it was like to be down there yesterday, being able to hear the president speak and whatnot?
Okay. Well, let me give you just a little background about my journey to Selma on yesterday. Yesterday, I traveled with three buses. One bus was filled with members from Ebenezer Baptist Church. The second bus, the one that I was on, was Mayor Kasim Reed's bus with his various employees and their families and people from his administration. And then our lead bus was a bus full of SCLC members, civil rights legends, and people who were either the widows of the organizers of this march, and Jose Williams's children and grandchildren were on the bus with me. So when I tell you that I was in the midst of people so connected to this moment, I almost cried from Atlanta to Selma. That's how emotional it was. We had police escorts from Atlanta all the way to Selma. So every county we passed, we had police escorts. and we were escorted directly in. Now, I'm not bragging about that to say that it was because we were VIPs, but that is historically how it had to happen the very first time it happened. Those folks had to have police escort. They had actually government-mandated police escort at every crossing of a county line. So that is how we entered. And then when we got there, the energy was simply, it was very humbling and incredible. I had a chance to go over to Brown Chapel AME Church. I am a sixth-generation AME, so I wanted to go back there. I hadn't been there since I was 13 years old. And we get there, and the entire congressional delegation is there at a worship service and visiting Brown Chapel AME at the same time. Reverend Barber delivered the sermon there, and that's Reverend Barber, the father of Moral Mondays from up in North Carolina. And then certainly last but not least, Melissa Harris Perry was airing from that location, so we had a chance to engage with her, and then we went over to the speech. And I understand that many of the pundits are calling President Obama's speech yesterday the new I Have a Dream. I don't know if it's the new I Have a Dream, but it's definitely the new We Have a Mission. And the speech was, it was eloquently delivered, eloquently written, but it was just a moment in time that I am so glad I had a chance to participate in.
Well, I'm so glad that she was able to, you know, be down there and was able to report to us on how humbling and how much of a spiritual experience it was to be down there. Now, I'm going to go over to Chris Long right quick, because Chris is also having, being that he's an LGBT man who is in a committed relationship, Alabama and the civil rights movement has something very close to his heart. Chris, would you like to expound on what Selma means to you?
Yeah, I would like to just say that something the president has echoed in many speeches he's given, that he doesn't, and I heard this yesterday on CNN from Van Jones and from some other people, that he doesn't want to be possibly known as the first African-American president. He wants to go down in history as sort of a Mount Rushmore president. And he sees the 50th anniversary of Selma as not being just a watershed for African-Americans, but his opportunity to remind people in America that the struggle not only for African-Americans is not done, but for Hispanic-Americans, for women, for LGBT people. And that is, I think, the message that he would probably want to have people take away from yesterday's events, is that, yeah, in 50 years we've come so far, but we still have so many more places to go, and not just for one sect of society, but for all of us. Our great mission as a democracy is not yet done. We have not yet formed that more perfect union for everyone, and that is what I take from it. And I, as I was expressing yesterday on social media, I am extremely disappointed in my state senate, especially my state senators, when 38 of them on Thursday passed a bill that would discriminate and allow businesses to not serve me as an LGBT person. And if that's not a parallel to the struggle the men and women in Selma had, I don't know what is. And I pray that all of our friends in the House do all they can to defeat legislation such as that when it comes to their desks in the coming weeks.
Well, I thank you for giving your remarks and whatnot. So let's get into the meat and potatoes of this. We're here to talk today about the America Works Plan and what that meant for those people in the show. But we want to talk about what would that mean for us in real time, real America. What would that mean, full employment, and half of the and also, what would it mean for Americans to have half of the entitlements that we presently have taken away? Or better yet, let's not use the word entitlements. Let's use earned benefit program, because we all know that all of us have at some point in time paid into this system. So how would it be to have half of those benefits taken back? And would it be beneficial to provide for full employment? Anybody wants to chime in? I'll start off with Mr. Jackson, so from an economic standpoint, can you explain to me what you think about that?
Well, I think the first thing you have to take into account is that entitlement spending accounts for a lot of consumption spending in our GDP. So the impoverished have to spend their income. And so GDP consumption makes up the largest percentage of our GDP. Consumption is 67% of our GDP. And so you ultimately want every class in America spending because, you know, we are driven by consumption in America. There's a lot of questions that you want to ask economically about a policy like this. So I think that you take away the entitlement spending, you're taking away the jobs.
You're dead, Mr. Jackson?
I can't hear him.
You must be going through a bad spot there somewhere going through Selma. I heard you saying when you was talking about how you said the consumption spending is 67% of the GDP. So what you're saying is that if we take away that spending, we take away the low income spectrum's ability to spend, then we'll have some negative effects on the economy? Well, I take it he might be in that hit that bad spot. So, Kimberlyn, what would be your thoughts on the food?
What I was about to say is when we talk about Selma, and I'll get to the point of view of the question, but I was in Selma at 13 years old with the AME Church. We went over as young people to a program that was at Brown Chapel at that time. And I'll just tell you, I was 13 about 100 years ago. So going back to Selma yesterday, one of the things that was extremely striking was the fact that very little, if anything, has changed there. Scout, I know that, you know, I was in Cuba last month. And so the country of Cuba is one of these places that with the embargo beginning in 1959, that time sort of stood still in terms of its infrastructure and some other things. Well, in Selma, it feels like time has literally stopped and stood still as well. We know that right now, so they were saying that back in the time of the march, the unemployment rates there in Selma were abysmally low, abysmally high. Well, right now, with the national being at 5.7, Selma's unemployment rate is probably about between 11% to 12%. So when we are talking about unemployment and job creation and things of that nature, we have to realize that we are still fighting a very old demon still. And so when we begin to speak from the perspective of policy and what's next and what can we do, we still have some old business that we still have to discuss and deal with, I think, still first.
Yeah, and I agree with you totally, that there is a lot of business to talk about. Mr. Jackson, if you got came back on, I want you to go ahead and finish your statement that you were making, and I can come back to you, Kimberlyn. Mr. Jackson, you hit a bad spot there. We keep forgetting we're running down them country roads that sometimes cell coverage drops out. So when you dropped off, you were talking about that consumption is being 67% of the total GDP. And so I'm thinking that if we take away that income from the lower middle class and our impoverished members of society, that will have a negative impact upon our economic system. Am I correct?
It can. We got to ask ourselves fundamentally some really important questions when we're making economic policy. We have to ask us, what type of unemployment is it? There's several types of unemployment. You've got cyclical, which is a result of usually a recession. And so you'll have an increase in unemployment during a recession. You've got frictional unemployment, which is the unemployment is basically that happens seasonally. When people are in between jobs, there is that portion when someone is going from one job to another that they are unemployed. And then you have structural unemployment, which means the jobs out there are not being filled by the population that wants the jobs. And so you have to ask that question. And that brings me to talking about the natural rate of unemployment. The natural rate of unemployment is when frictional and structural unemployment are at lows. So you can't really do much about cyclical because the business cycle is going to happen. But what you can do is try to make sure that the jobs out there can be filled by those looking for jobs. And frictional, that means that you're going to have less turnover time. So when you're in between jobs, people, you know, that would be like lowering it from 6 months to 1 month. That would be improving the frictional unemployment. Another thing we have to ask about programs like this is, what is the multiplier? The multiplier is the factor, the increment of which income is going to exceed by this spending. It's basically like a public return on investment. And so the thing about America Works is that this has been played out many, many times by many different parties. Basically, you know, you had the New Deal, but you've had the Bush tax cuts. You had the Bush wartime spending. You had the 2009 stimulus. And those were all kind of your expansion fiscal policies, where there was really big government spending in order to stimulate the economy. But, you know, you have to ask those questions before you make those policies and figure out, is the jobs lost, is the consumption loss going to be offset by the jobs created? So that's a question that policymakers have to answer.
Well, okay, and I get where you're coming from. Now, Mr. Sloan, since you have a tendency to understand how these type of policies play out to the voters and to people as a whole, the man on the street, if such a policy was proposed by a sitting president today, what do you think will be the reaction from the American people, and do you think the American people will be supportive of such an action?
The easy answer would be no. As John was saying, the largest part of our economy and the GDP is the consumption. So when you have the majority of your population that in some way or another is dependent on things like this, and you take away income they have, and that makes them harder to buy their daily goods, to pay their rent, to do their grocery shopping, things like that, no, you're going to have, I would say, not to be extreme, but you would have a very angry population that will potentially have some negative effects at the ballot box, and I would dare say with cuts this big, if not in the street, because you're cutting off your nose to spite your face. You want to grow the economy, but you're taking spending out of it. So how are you going to grow the largest part of your GDP, as John was saying, when you're taking money out of those people's pockets that they can't spend? And politically, with our current environment, this wouldn't pass anyway in our economy. So no, it wouldn't be possible at all. And to piggyback off something that my lovely friend Ms. Carter was saying, you know, to watch television yesterday and to see Selma, Alabama, to see it downtown, she's correct. It's like a third world country in some places. They have bathrooms with residents that don't even have running sewer. They have septic tanks that back up into their tubs every day. They have 1 in 5 children in Selma, and the counties around it are in poverty. And this is the problem you should worry about first. And I think the two main problems with President Underwood's plan is that, one, it's a temporary fix. You're putting a Band-Aid on a broken leg. You can provide someone a job, but providing a job is not the answer. Building a climate and preparing people for the jobs you currently have to address that sort of unemployment that John was talking about, where people are not filling jobs either because, A, they don't want them, or, B, they're not qualified for them, that's the problem. And most of the time, these infrastructure-type jobs like President Underwood was talking about in his proposal are temporary. You know, you're building a bridge, you're building a building, you're doing whatever. But what happens when that project is done? Does that person just go back to being unemployed again? So you've just created another problem. You haven't solved anything. And I think those are the problems. So, no, it wouldn't meet with good resolution by the people. And, of course, you would not even be solving the problem at all. So it's not a good solution and certainly wouldn't pass the mustard by the populace.
Ms. Carter,
And one of the things that I want to say as well, Scott, when we talk about, sort of where we are right now. So last month in February, we added about 295, between almost 300,000 jobs. We're talking about a 5.5% unemployment rate overall. But like Mr. Lester said, there are these different types of unemployment. But what we really have to start to drill down to talking about, not only do we have to talk about, these levels or these types of subgroups of unemployment, but we have to talk about who is unemployed, because the who is even a larger problem than the what. So when you're talking about 10.4% of African Americans in this country are unemployed, and how that number can begin to double or even triple when you talk about our young people between the ages of 18 to 25. And then when you move into the sphere of gender, how that number begins to expand and implode. So we really have to talk about the who. And piggybacking on what Chris is saying about this endemic pattern of poverty that's happening in America, and the number of our children who are being born into homes of poverty and things of that nature. So you have to really begin to talk about, this who and what this face of unemployment is. And when we talk about the job that we need to create, well, I agree with Chris that these infrastructure jobs are Band-Aids. They can be deemed as short-sighted in some type of way. But at the same time, I'd rather have a short-term check than a no-term check, right? So we have to have some meaningful conversation about that. But then you have to look over to the side, to the horizon, and over at the horizon is this horrible, this political infighting and this inability to move the needle in a Congress that seems to be set against itself to be progressive and to move along a positive line. And then the overarching thing that I hope that we may be able to talk about and we may not is what types of jobs are we really talking about here? Because with the pace of technology and with the pace of what happens in a world where there are no more, quote-unquote, the types of factory jobs or the types of jobs on the base or the types of jobs that we can remember that used to help to establish the middle class, well, we know there are jobs now, there are jobs that kids are in school for now that haven't even been created yet. So we still have to, we have to talk about that. And how do we begin to re-engineer Americans to prepare for these new jobs that are on the horizon? How do we begin? What type of policy, or how do we begin to have those types of conversations?
Yeah, that was a story that I read right after the House of Cards episode started streaming. There was a story that I read that actually talked about some of the same things we're talking about today. But that was another part of the puzzle that they spoke on in that piece that none of us has touched on. They was like, okay, we asking what kind of job, who's going to work the job, but then it was the question asked where the job is going to be. Because let's say you have a city like Atlanta, or you have a city like Charlotte, that your larger cities, you may still have more people than you have jobs, but then you may have a place maybe like like we have in North Dakota with the oil boom that's taking place up there. They actually have negative unemployment because they need workers. So you have places like that.
I guess that means I need to get out of way, huh?
So you have those type of situations in which are we willing to have people move to go to jobs and who's going to pay for them to move to areas where the jobs are? So there's a lot of different questions that need to be asked. And so does anybody have an opinion on that particular part? Let's say that there are still more people than there are jobs in one particular region, and how do we get the people to go to the region where the jobs are?
Well, this is John. I think that's a multifaceted answer. I think it starts with just informing the people of where opportunities lie, and I think that starts at a very young level. I think I meet way too many youth out there who don't know where the opportunities are. I don't think, and I'm not going to shift the blame on educators. I'm going to shift the blame on the entire system. We need a system that makes it a priority to inform our upcoming people, our upcoming next generation, about where opportunities lie, and they can make a better decision on life, on what direction they want to go in life based on that empirical information. Another thing I want to say is that one thing that unites all classes of people right now, your 1% investors, very poor, is wage growth. On our end, we are looking at in the banking industry's end, we are looking at wage growth as an indicator of when you're going to see an interest rate hike. And so that interest rate hike, is not going to happen until we see that wage growth. And so the wage growth is going to be good for everybody. It's going to be good for investors because we're not going to see an asset bubble where the market could potentially crash if we see that wage growth and the Federal Reserve can raise rates. But we can also see wages that are keeping up with inflation. And so real importantly, the bottom line is we want jobs for people that are going to keep up with the cost of living. And as of the past decade, longer than that, the past several decades, wages haven't been keeping up with inflation. And I think we've got to inform and educate people where opportunities lie, but we've also got to do something about wage growth in general. And it's not as simple as, raising the minimum wage. That helps, but
exactly.
It's beyond that.
He makes an excellent, excellent point. And if I could just jump in here just a moment, I think that it's really important that that all of us, I know that everyone on this call has a network has a power map of people who are engaged in some form of advocacy or policy making. And I think it's very important that we begin to embrace and throw our arms around Janet Yellen, the chair of the Fed, because one thing that I know about her is that she gets it. She knows that the economy remains too weak with stagnant wages and too much unemployment exists. And so she is really ready to be able to take on, she's really ready to take on these bankers too. But I'm saying that she's really ready to have that conversation. And I don't think we talk enough about how the Federal Reserve has a tremendous influence over our economy. And that where we are now, that if our feds don't cut the legs out from some of this massive acceleration, then we're going to continue to cost our communities millions of jobs and workers tens of billions of dollars in wages. And so we have to have these conversations with our advocates, with consumers, and with our community organizations to really begin to push and talk about how the Federal Reserve can help us with really creating a balanced national economic policy that prioritizes full employment and a balance in how wages are allocated.
Well, I'm going to stop right there, and we're going to go take a break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to pick up, and we're going to start talking about how this affects these affects communities and kind of pick up where you left off. And we're going to be back in about a minute and a half. This is Down South and Dirty with Scott Smith. Today I'm with Christopher Sloan, former chair of the Troup County Democratic Party and one of West Georgia's finest political analysts. I'm here with Kimberlyn Carter. Kim Flynn is a partner at Politics and a fine political strategist on her own. She's awesome. Mr. Jackson had to run. But he would like to let you know, if you have additional questions, you can send questions to his Twitter, which is @JJohnTheMarkets, and that's on Twitter. And we will have that up on our Facebook page. And he's a great, great economic source to be able to gather those questions from. But as we were going, before we went to the break, we were talking about different unemployment and how to fix our different communities and this, that, and the other. And I got a question I want to pose to the two of you. We, like for instance, me and Chris, LaGrange, Georgia, we have a lot of industry there, but our young people are not being able to take advantage of the jobs. They want to stay. They would love to stay in their town, but they're not able to stay. They go off school, they don't come back. So you also have these, so you have small town rural America, which has this brain drain taking place because young people don't have any opportunities. Do you think there's any type of way, and anyone you chime in, any type of way for us to be able to build up rural America again and get it back to work?
Well, in LaGrange, I don't know if you've seen the papers recently, but our mayor, our new mayor, I should say, he's only been here about 18 months in this job, has done something that mayors in the past haven't done, and he's gone to every section of the city, and you know I'm very critical of our people down here, but I can say he has done this. He's gone to every single section of the city, no matter what the demographics are or what the area is, and he's engaged the citizens, and he's engaged the young people. And one of the things that they're trying to do here locally is set up a youth council of people ranges between, like, 17 and 25 to ask for ideas when you are done with your secondary education and you're going to college. What kind of things would you like to see our area do? What can I as a mayor do to hold you here? And as a piggyback to that, there's also a section or a branch of the Chamber of Commerce. It's called LaGrange Hyper, and it is a group of young professionals from all sections of the workforce that is also doing the same thing, but these people are already in the workforce, and so it's asking them, what has kept you here or what brought you here? And so those are two of the things that LaGrange is doing, but one of the things that I wanted to mention on really fast before it gets off my brain is I think one of the main keys, and I'm probably going to touch on a subject very dear to Ms. Carter's heart, is education. And I've always heard from teachers and folks alike that you should dress for the job you want, not the job you have. And I think that when we have a workforce, and I'm always speaking for my area locally, as you know, about 6 years ago, we brought a huge manufacturer to this area, and they've added about 14,000 jobs to this area in the last 6 months, I mean, the last 6 years. They have had to go in on their own and invest millions of dollars in educating people to do the jobs that this manufacturer requires. And my only question would be, if these workforce members were already trained to do those types of jobs before this manufacturer came here, how many more jobs could have been created? So I think one of the pieces that we're really missing, and I know that Kimberlin is a big fan of education, is that President Underwood's plan and other things that we talk about, starting jobs and creating a good economy is great, but you have to make sure your workforce is trained for the jobs that are needed. And sometimes in certain areas, especially in the rural South, that doesn't happen. And I would agree with her what she said earlier. Any job is better than no job, and I'm certainly not saying don't have the jobs package, but have an arm of that that not only gives these people a job, but trains and keeps that job for them in the future. That way that Band-Aid doesn't become a Band-Aid and does become more of a cast that can fix the problem. And education in Georgia, as we know, has taken severe cuts in the last 8 years or more, and that's an issue that I think would be one of those systemic problems that she's been mentioning that need to be addressed.
He's absolutely right, and as you know, last year I was chief campaign strategist for Sanford Bishop in the 2nd congressional district, where we had 29 counties, and of those 29 counties, pretty much 24 to 25 of them are rural counties, and the congressional district borders the states of Alabama and of course Florida. And so I almost tore up a car making sure that I touched down and engaged people in every one of those counties. And so when I tell you that when I say that we have an incredible pandemic of lack and quality of life inequalities in the rural areas here in the state of Georgia, I can't say it or shout it loud enough. And when we talk about how we can begin to fix it, to re-energize it, and to give it a shot in the arm, there are four pillars that we have to engage. And so, And, of course, I didn't just come up with this. These are things that I've been having discussions with Sanford about what we need to do to put another shot in this thing. And one thing has to be our infrastructure. And when I'm talking about an infrastructure, I'm not just talking about let's make our roads better, let's get some cleaner water. I mean, all of those things are important. But we also have to look at even an infrastructure that can embrace and sustain access to technologies. Chris is absolutely right, education. If we think we're having education issues, because pretty much LaGrange and Macon and places like this, those folks consider, cities, right, sort of metropolitan areas compared to where they're currently residing. So when we talk about education and the type of education our young people are getting in these areas, I can tell you that we need to do some major and very serious overhauling there. Workforce development and citizen training. I was amazed at the number of even young people
in the rural areas that I engaged in who were not tech savvy. They're smartphone savvy, but not tech savvy. And we don't talk about that enough. Oh, yeah, it's great that you can text and Snapchat, watch a video, look at a training video on how to do something with your hair or put some false lashes in, but you can't use a mouse. You can't type. You don't know how to do any type of citizen-based research even through Google. So, you know, so that's a serious challenge when we're talking about training our citizens, building a workforce that can apply. Folks in McDonald's will tell you that sometimes they don't have as many people applying for jobs there because now you have to apply via computer. There's no more written application. So that's a barrier for some people to even apply to McDonald's. And then last but not least, we have to talk about, we've got to have incubators in these communities that also engage the idea of producing small businesses and encouraging entrepreneurship. I think sometimes we get, you know, stuck in this idea that everybody wants to go somewhere that's a 9-to-5 and smile and be happy and work for someone. When one thing that we're finding out about these millennials is that millennials want to be in these creative spaces. They want to create jobs for other people via their own businesses or some problem that they want to solve that can be solved through an idea or a business that they may create. So I think for me, those are some of the four pillars to how we begin to buttress and support some of these rural areas.
You know, I'm glad that you brought up that last pillar that you brought up about entrepreneurship, because I was sitting in a meeting a couple of months ago in LaGrange, and we were talking about our gang problem and how we get our kids involved in our youth. And yes, Mayor Thornton was there, and he's been doing an excellent job. Even for me, you know, this is me as a Democrat, giving some props to a Republican that is doing an excellent job of, you know, of engaging his community, and that's Mayor Thornton. But we were sitting in this meeting, and everybody was talking about jobs. Everybody was talking about jobs. Everybody kept talking about good jobs. And when I and a couple of other individuals brought up the entrepreneurial aspect of job creation, of economic development, most of the people in the room were lost. And I found that a lot of people, and this may be just my opinion, but I found that a lot of people are seriously fearful of entrepreneurship. It's like, Evan, you got so many, and I don't know if this is a part of the fact that we have our brethren on the other side of the aisle calling entitlement, but people are feeling wanting to be safe. I know for many years as I worked a job, that what kept me from going to be an entrepreneur was I wanted to be safe. Now that I stepped out the door and went on my own, I enjoy the freedom more than I enjoy the safety. So what I'm trying to get to is that how do we, through education and possibly even through the political process, encourage people to say, okay, I'm not going to take the safe route. I'm going to take the route that gives me more freedom, because I think at the end of the day, that will, instead of having a job program, having an entrepreneurial growth program, will better benefit America than us spending billions of dollars putting people to work instead of spending money putting in the small business owner hands, not large business owners, but small business owners, putting money in their hands to help them create jobs. What y'all think about that?
I'll relate to you another anecdote that I had from yesterday, that I was seeing some interviews when people were down participating with Kimberlyn Down and Selma. And one of the people that was interviewed extensively by CNN was former mayor and ambassador Andrew Young. And he spoke to Randy Kaye on CNN. And one of the things that she asked him specifically about the struggle, and this relates directly to your question, is did what you – do you believe that you achieved your mission in Selma with apathy being as high as it is, or do you think apathy among voters, especially minority voters, is a huge problem? That's the reason why things are the way they are, because you had young men like you 50 years ago who would get beaten to go vote, and now you have people that can't even get bussed to go vote. And he said, Randy, the biggest problem is not apathy. The biggest problem is barriers. And this relates directly to what Kimberlyn was saying. We have to always understand, to get out of this little box that we're in, that there's a, there are many things that have been put up that you may not recognize sometimes as barriers to development of certain classes of people. And when I use the word poverty, poverty to me doesn't have a race. A lot of people in West Virginia and places like that that are in poverty are more Caucasian people than anything else. And that's not a race thing to me. And so I think that when you speak like she did, which is correct, about, you know, we don't get as many job applications anymore because they're on computers, I would hope, but you always have to be questionable of the system, I would hope that's not a barrier that's been put in place purposely to keep the access to people away from that situation. Take the dismantling of the Civil Rights Voting Act by the Supreme Court, I would hope, was not just done on purpose to keep people away from the ballot boxes. As we can see in the last couple of cycles, that is something that you need to make it be understood. And so you have to understand it's not just about jobs. It's a total education system. And Kimberlyn is right. Activating your networks and understanding that the areas we come from, we are as much responsible for that growth in that area as the folks that are in the offices. And if you educate people and you go out on your own, you talk about it, you fight for things that need to be done, it won't happen today and it won't happen tomorrow, but eventually I hope that right wins in the end. And that would be how you would get that done. Your story, Scout, would be extremely important, not only just in LaGrange but anywhere else. Talk about how you were always taught, well, this is the safe way, this is the good way, we're going to work in this factory, we're going to do this, or we're going to be at this plant. But how anybody has within them the entrepreneurial spirit to go out and work. And I think that especially among poverty-stricken people, hearing that story and knowing it's possible from someone who just 3-4 years ago was in that factory environment would do more than any politician could do. So that would be what I would tell you to do. Our own story is powerful. I know, you guys know the places that I came from. We know where Kimberlyn came from. We know where you came from. And the more we speak and the more we repeat our story to people who are like us and to people who need to hear that story, the more change takes effect. So the president can't do it by himself. No man is an island. It takes all of us. And so I think that's what was the biggest thing, is even if your mayor is not going to hear you, keep speaking your story. Keep letting young people know you can do this. I did this. And I think that's what one of the ways you get the entrepreneurial spirit going. You pay it forward. You talk about what you did. You give opportunities when you grow your business. You know, that's what I think needs to happen.
And you know, one of the things that when we talk about today is International Women's Day. It's the International Day of Women. And when we look at even some of these third world countries or places like in Africa and India, where these countries have experienced these economic boosts, maybe and it has become Nigeria also is this perfect example of how huge the economic boost is happening in Ghana and some of these other places. And it has happened through the World Bank and IMF and some of these other folks doing those micro loan projects where they became these small business incubators and loaned entrepreneurs the money to start their own businesses. In these countries, most of them, and specifically doing it with women and really watching some of these economies, you know, come around and come up. And so when Atlanta, looking down the road, started noticing some declines in their unemployment and some dips and highs and lows and things, as you can see, they have Bloomberg Philanthropies and Arthur Blank and a couple of these other folks
who are putting money into this women's entrepreneurship incubator that they cut the ribbon on a couple of months ago. Because one thing they realized, too, is that when you put a woman in business, and I'm not trying to be a gender elitist, but I'm just saying the fact, when you put a woman in business or a woman entrepreneur, they're finding that the businesses last longer, that they grow, that they have a very aggressive, sustainable model. And so we do have to talk about, Scout, job creation through business creation, not creating environments for Walmart to get bigger or for Target to get bigger, but creating economic environments for small businesses to occur. And then we begin, then that's when Trutland employs Trutland County. You understand what I'm saying? I think it's so powerful for a Macon person like myself to be able to employ people here from home and like Chris said, and be able to share my story and to be able to help them to craft a story. So I think that these are the types of conversations that we really do need to have more.
And I did nothing to talk about what John said earlier and what Elliot, you had mentioned, about sometimes when we do projects like this and mention things like that, the jobs may not be created where the people are. One of the things that I've learned in my very small time in politics is that there's never one right solution to a question. And so, yeah, you could create jobs in big cities and in turn encourage folks to move there and do things like that. But I think something that is example of what I've tried to do and what Kimberlyn's tried to do and what you've tried to do, sometimes it's not that easy to make a person leave an area they were born and raised in just because there's a job somewhere else. And
right.
I think that what's a key and something that we can do is say, you know what, you don't have to move to find a job. You can, through your
Absolutely.
Own gumption, through your own education, you can build and enrich your own area, because by doing things with one site saying, okay, we're going to have problems in big cities and we're going to encourage all the folks to move there, that's how rural Georgia died.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need that to happen again. We need to educate these kids and tell them, you know, come back to Cuthbert. Come back to Tifton. Come back to Fort Valley. Come back to these places that you now have the tools to build where you're from. And that's
Absolutely.
One reason why I never have left, because
mm-hmm.
you can't give up on where you came from sometimes.
Absolutely. And that's why I came back. And you know, I agree with you totally, Chris. That is exactly why I came back. You know, I wanted to brighten the corner where I was from, right? And one last thing to piggyback on something Chris was saying earlier. Forbes magazine a couple of weeks ago they had some research that talked about how almost 40% of minority teens want tech careers, okay? As a matter of fact, of all of the kids because they interviewed young people, high schoolers, as a matter of fact. And so out of all of them that they interviewed, removing race as a category, 70% of these kids were interested in tech jobs, STEM-based types of jobs. So we're talking about kids from rural, urban, from all over, who are interested in these types of jobs. So the question becomes, when we know this, when research says this, how do we then, when does the conversation begin then on how do we create the spaces or the environment for these kids to be able to attain their dreams? Because clearly, if my dream is not to go and work at the, I don't want to go over here and I don't want to be a school teacher or I don't want to be a policeman. I mean, these kids are not saying, oh, when I grow up, I want to be a doctor, lawyer, fireman, or teacher. They're not saying that, So we are stuck again back in a time where we think we want kids growing up, okay, you finish your high school diploma, then you go to college, then you do this and then you do that. And that's just not the path now. It's just not the path. And so we have to have real meaningful conversations, and I'm glad to hear that the mayor of LaGrange is attempting to have that conversation. But we have to really begin to have those types of conversations, and then begin to set our policies, our strategic plans, and things of that nature to that end, for the betterment of these local communities.
She's right, and to understand, like she was saying, that for 50 or more years, the mantra has been, you grow up, you go to high school, you apply to college, you go to college, you come out, you get a job, you build a house with 2.5 kids, a picket fence, and then you die. That is not the answer for everybody. Not everyone needs to have a master's degree. Not everyone needs to go to college. There are many well and high-paying jobs that our Department of Technical Education does a great job filling.
Mm-hmm.
There are many
mm-hmm.
great-paying jobs that will give you just on-the-job training. So, again,
right.
there is never
right.
one solution for the problem. And one of the things that our politicians, for the large part, have been telling us is that it's, like I say, high school, college, job, retirement. And not everyone's made to go to college, and that is perfectly okay. I have 16 nieces and nephews, and, you know, I hold 2 degrees, and I work my tail off to get them, and now I got to pay back till I'm 80 to pay them off, which is also another problem, but that's another phone call probably. Is how student loan debt
right.
is ridiculously
that's right.
high.
Degrees, not debt. Degrees, not debt. Exactly.
I think it's $1.3 trillion. So if you look at the value of what you're going to make in a salary over the lifetime of your job you're going to get, it's not even worth getting a degree sometimes anymore because
right.
it's so high. But that's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
The key is my path is not the only correct path. Everyone has their own road to find, and I think it's okay to tell kids, you want to go to school and be a line worker in the Kia factory? Fantastic. That's a great job. You'll make lots of money. You want to go be, follow Kimberlin's path and be a pundit and go travel and meet all these people and do that kind of work and be an educator as well? That's fine. Or you want to be like Representative Kendrick and do 6 jobs and have 25 degrees as to tease her? That's fine as well. Not everyone's path is the right path. The key is trying to find someone somewhere to invest in you and say, what do you want to do? What is your path? And to know, that, as President Clinton said at the 2008 convention, nobody is made by themselves. No man is self-made. Every politician wants you to believe they were born in the log cabin they built themselves. But that's not how it works. We all have somebody somewhere to thank for getting us where we are.
You know, and I'm glad that you talked about everybody's path not being the same because, you know, I found that I spent a very, 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 very large portion of my life trying to fit myself into that hole. It was like you go to school, you graduate, and for me, there were only 2 choices. You either went to college or you joined the military. And I did both. I actually joined the military, got out of the military, then I went to school. And school was, you know, a lot of people find it surprising that I do not hold a college degree. But what I did get instilled in me was a love for learning. And learning, knowing that knowledge is not necessarily education is key, it's knowledge that is key. And you can educate, you know, some people have to sit in the classroom because if you gave them a book and told them, hey, read this book, learn what's in this book, go do what this book say do, they wouldn't be able to do it. They have to be in a structured environment with somebody to hold their hand and lead them through. And then you got some people who operate a lot better on their own. You tell them here and go take it 1 minute and they can do it and do it with the same amount of skill that somebody who we're formally educated. So I think one of the biggest things that we have to do with promoting is promoting people being able to, promoting a system that allows people a little bit more freedom in the path that they take on how they get their education. We know there's certain key things that everyone needs. We know there's certain key things that we have to have. But what is that person that we need to find a way, and it may take 50 years to figure it out. And maybe somebody knows today that we just got too many lobbyists working against it. They know the way to do it today. But with that being said, I really, anybody else got anything to say?
The only thing that I wanted, well, it's not necessarily a say, but to encourage, the Center for Popular Democracy, they are doing some really incredible research and white papers and information and community organizing around a lot of the topics that we discussed today. And recently they produced something called Fed Up, the National Campaign for a Strong Economy. And I would just encourage everyone to read it, to also read their facts and figures, and their report on unemployment across the board. And they also have state-specific reports. But, Scal, I just have to thank you once again for not only giving me this opportunity and inviting me on your show, but also for just being an example to all of us living courageously, daring courageously to really be the person or answer the call that you believe is within you to do to improve upon the lives of others. I haven't had a chance to say that to you privately, so I thought it'd just be perfect to say it to you publicly.
Well, I thank you. Ms. Sloan, you got any last words?
No, I would just like to remind people, like Kimberly said, that, you know, you have your own path to find. Everyone is a vital part of their community, and to not listen to the mantra that people tell you that there's only one right way to do anything, because if people in the past have listened to that there's only one right way and it is the way it is, we wouldn't have had great men like John Lewis getting in trouble. So believe in yourself, believe in your community, and don't give up on who you are. So that's, and I would echo her sentiments as well, that I've known you for 5 or 6 years now, and I'm very honored and impressed to be your friend and proud of the mission that you've made and the path you've taken, and I wish you much success in the battle and fights that are still coming.
Well, I want to thank both of you for coming on, because both of you are very good friends of mine, and you've always been, and I can always call on you two and many others, that when I need somebody to come in, speak, do something, that y'all are there. Y'all are there, and a lot of people don't understand that, you know, when you become a part of a community, regardless of a business community, an activist community, whatever type of community, those communities are important. Those bonds are important. And, you know, one of the things that I set out to do when I started this endeavor of doing this show and the other shows that I'm starting to do is it's about telling stories. It's about telling stories. I want people to be able to come here and tell their story. I want to be able to tell stories. Because what people are, even in the day, now with social media being the way it is, you have people telling stories, but at the same time, people are getting disconnected from one another. And I just want whatever we do here, I want it to be able to go out and take a tangible manifestation in the real world, not just in cyberspace, not just online, but to take a tangible, I want people to go out and take action. So if any of the people who are listening to the show today, if you heard great ideas that you think can be tried in your community, in your town, your city, your state, go out and be a mentor to somebody. Tell somebody your story. Be willing to go step out. Go step out. Jump out on faith. And do what is going to make you be the best person you can be. God made each one of us unique and for a purpose. And I hope that I can get you two to come back on for other shows. I want to tell my listeners there's a brand new show here on Down South and Dirty Radio. It's called Hump Day Prime Time. It will be on Wednesday nights. At 7 o'clock, we will be doing underreported headlines, trending headlines, and stuff of just great importance to people to know about. And, again, I want to thank my guests, John Jackson, remember, @JJ John Markets on Twitter. I want to thank Christopher Sloan for coming on. I want to thank Kimberly Carter from the Super Second District for coming on and just gracing us with all the knowledge that they gave us today. And I thank you. And this is Down, South, and Dirty with Sal Smith. See y'all again next Sunday.